freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We've got to stop them! They're going to kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they the government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone or human being!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part, and you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop, and you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
You called down the thunder, well now you've got it.
Right, you tell them I'm coming, and hell's coming with me, you hear? Hell's coming with me!
Revolution Radio!
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyalty? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given right, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at revolution.radio.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Okay. Good morning. Good afternoon. Good evening. It's evening somewhere in the world. Welcome to Free Association. It's Saturday afternoon here, 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the UK. It's 11 a.m. on the East Coast in the States. And today I'm just going to talk about the 80s, the 1980s. I did a couple of podcasts over the course of the week, and I've been to a funeral service this week, so my head's kind of been there. But I did some podcast shows earlier in the week. They were quite heavy. They were all kind of germ theory v terrain theory and quite technical. Not that I'm technical, but I was playing videos that were technical. So I've had kind of 3 days of that, and I've more or less got to the conclusion that terrain theory is the way to go. And I'm satisfied with a potential mechanism for transferring over belief in disease is the problem. It's not a specific virus, it's not a specific bacteria, it's just a belief in disease, and the belief in disease spreads mind to mind. It's a thing that's in human consciousness, so we all have to be careful with it. A little bit of care and a choice about who you spend your time with is always a good thing anyway, but in the case of belief in disease, belief in limitation, belief in lack, all of those things are the same type of belief system. So pulling yourself out of that type of belief system is a tricky thing. But you have to know it's there before you can pull yourself out of it. So you have to understand a little bit about the mechanism. Anyway, that's what I was doing at the beginning of the week. Took a couple of days off, had this funeral in the middle of it. And the guy who the funeral service was for was a music TV guy, who was a producer on a TV show in the 80s. So that took me back to the 80s a little bit when I was a student in Newcastle, and I was just thinking about where I was and what I was doing. And a lot of the time I was in Newcastle City Hall, which is a venue that holds about 2,500 people. And basically everybody who was coming through town, everybody who was coming through the north of England on a tour would play the City Hall, or the Mayfair was the other place in Newcastle for rock bands and kind of punk bands and people like that. But the City Hall was a mainstream pop and rock venue, basically. And I saw Ozzy Osbourne play there. I saw Ronnie James Dio play there. Never saw Black Sabbath, but the Ozzy Osbourne tour that I saw was the live album. Promoting the live album that was all Black Sabbath tunes, which was called I can't remember. It was after Bark at the Moon, I remember that, but I don't remember the name of the album. Anyway, it was a live album with Brad Gillis on guitar, and it was a live album that was slight reinterpretation of Black Sabbath tunes with a different band, and a good show. I remember a dwarf being hung at one point. I can't remember what that was about really, but that was part of the stage show. So Ozzy Osbourne being an entertainer, lots of audience participation, and the death of a dwarf. Ronnie James Dio, if I remember rightly, was carrying two pyramids and a sphinx around with him, so there was an Egyptian theme going on. Again, I can't remember whether it was the Holy Diver tour or not. If there's an album called Egypt, though, that would be the tour that I saw. And a remarkably good show. Not very much room on the stage at the City Hall. Actually, I met somebody recently who was a stage manager at the City Hall, so we've got a lot to talk about over the next few weeks. What I'm going to do this week, though, I'm not going to say all that much. I'm just going to play a little bit of Ronnie James Dio, and then I've got about a 30-minute piece of Black Sabbath documentary, which covers their history. Covers the early history in particular. I might let it run through into Ronnie James Dio, or I might stop it at 1979. I haven't decided yet. We'll see how I feel. But this is Ronnie James Dio being interviewed and asked a question about good and evil. Oh, let me share my screen first. Best to do it properly. Okay, it should work now. It's running again.
Well, I don't believe in either heaven and hell as a place to go to. That you know, when we die, we're going to go down and burn for a while. And if we're good, we're going to go up there and be happy for a while. Or purgatory, where all the poor little baptized babies are hanging out. You know, I think anybody who's got that kind of, anybody who came up with that idea that there's going to be a place where little children are going to be hanging out for the rest of their lives, you know, is either the sickest person on earth or the most stupid person on earth. And I think both of those things apply. So I don't believe in any of those things. My belief in heaven and hell is right here. This is where we are. This is heaven, this is hell. You make your own heaven, you make your own hell. Hell, good and evil, God, the devil, reside in each one of us. I don't have to go to a place to pray. Yeah, pray inside myself. I can pray to whomever I want to inside myself and get the same results. I don't need to be told by a priest that I'm bad or to be told by a nun that I'm not learning my project properly and get smacked on the head and with a ruler. Who the hell are you to do that to me? Or to be told that here's God and God is a guy who's been nailed upon a piece of wood. It's not the way I want to think of life. I don't think of it that way. And with all the religions that they are preaching all the same things, it's real one great big homogenized thing anyway. At the end of the day, if we all just believe in the same thing, you know, that we got a choice between good and evil. Hey, make your choice. That's all it's about to me. So writing those songs perhaps brought out a little bit of my cynical side, but what it brought out of me is what I believe in life. And that is that, you know, we are the last in line. And, you know, there is heaven and hell if you consider that it's what people do to you that make it heaven and hell, which is, that goes right to the song. The world is full of kings and queens who blind your eyes and steal your dreams. That's heaven and hell. That's what heaven and hell is. The heaven when the people tell you how good they're going to treat you, and the hell when you find out it was all a lie, wasn't it? That's what heaven and hell is.
Ronnie J.
There you go. Just a short clip, but I think he says that very well. And he expresses it very clearly. It's all psychological. Heaven and hell are all expressions of my psychology. If I want to live in heaven, I've got the choice. If I want a positive, empowering, good life, whatever good life means, whatever positive means, whatever empowering means, it's there. It's there in your psychology, and it'll express. Whether you want it to or not, it'll express out. So you might as well make a positive choice for you and a positive choice for the people around you. Very, very simple philosophy. Well, very effective in the end, I think. So the next piece I want to play, it's 45 minutes, so I'll play about half an hour of this, and then I'll ramble on for 10 minutes. 15 minutes at the end, and we'll see where we go. This is a documentary about Black Sabbath that was made in 2010, and I think it sums up their career pretty effectively. They're kind of accidental Satan worshippers, if there is such a thing. But the thread's there in the story, so it's explained in the documentary. The way that it happened. I'll just let it play. I've watched most of this already, so I'm quite happy to watch it again though.
They were just four poor lads from Birmingham who changed the face of rock and roll.
There wasn't anything like it before them. Black Sabbath was like, wow.
I mean, as you walk on stage in this little club, and you're riveted to that guy on stage.
They were that devil-worshipping band.
Everything was excess.
I crossed over a line where there was no coming back.
They were in a den of vipers. They couldn't get out.
Black Sabbath hit the charts in 1970 with a new brand of heavy rock swirling with occult imagery. But their dark content led to something they never expected. Some feared them as Satanists.
And we never, ever said that we were into Satan or anything like that.
It wasn't what the band was about at all. Not at all.
I had no idea people actually practiced that kind of stuff, so I thought it was just a goof, you know.
Well, back then, the imagery was the only thing that you had to connect that artist. So nobody knew that these guys didn't worship the devil and weren't, you know, dark Satan lovers.
That first impression would prove difficult to shake.
When we went on tour, it was very strange because people were very frightened of us. They wouldn't come backstage or anything. They were frightened to meet us, you know.
The band had somehow managed to offend people holding completely opposite views. Devil worshippers were disappointed that Black Sabbath wasn't the real thing, and people of traditional faith took to the streets in protest.
And you will die and you will burn in hell.
We had people that were actually very, very dangerous. They wanted to make sure that we didn't live another day.
March 1st, 1971. 2 weeks into their second U.S. tour, halfway through a Memphis show, the anger boiled over.
One guy got on stage once with a big dagger, and he was going to assassinate Tony.
And he got past security and everything, and I never even seen him.
And Tony sort of turned around and walked off stage as this guy was running after him.
I just heard this scuffle behind me, and they got him to the floor, and he was some religious chap.
We got to the dressing room, and there was this big inverted cross in blood on the dressing room door that this guy had slashed his wrist and sprayed all this blood all over the door.
We had several attacks or potential attacks on us. It became something of a normal thing.
You know, black magic, no way. They were just really good guys, and all they wanted to do was work and play music. That's all they wanted.
It had all started so innocently for Black Sabbath. They were four boys from Birmingham, England, with a big dream. And if ever a city could produce the godfathers of heavy metal, it was this grim working-class town, which still bore the scars of German bombings years after World War II.
Well, Ozzy and Tony had gone to school with each other.
I never used to hang around with these guys at school. I was in a different level, so a different class.
Ozzy was more of a bit of a nuisance in the way.
It was like the fighting all the time. They're always fighting.
But there was a reason for his manic behavior.
I was incredibly dyslexic. I still am very, very dyslexic. And I suffer from attention deficit disorder. So they didn't realize what that was in them days.
All four came from working class families. Ozzy's circumstances were the most extreme.
My mother and my father and the six of us lived in a two-bedroom house.
It's a whole different culture where they were raised. I mean, no money.
We never had a car. We never went on holiday. That's all we knew, so we didn't know anything different, you know.
And we talk in America about having no money, and I had it hard, and I lived in a trailer. But your trailer had a toilet and a bathroom in, and you had clean clothes to put on. I know that Ozzy didn't.
The landscape was a violent landscape. We had the Irish Republican Army bombing us all the time. Buildings would blow up, you know. That was part of being in Birmingham.
That whole area of the Midlands is a very working class area. You know what I mean? People are hard. There's a lot of attitude. And a lot of the great, heavy, darker music has come from that place in England. I don't think they call it the Black Country for no reason.
I mean, a lot of England is tough. When people make fun of, oh, the British, like, really? Don't do that in Britain, because some guy will come over there and tear your head off.
If life in Birmingham was bleak, prospects for a decent future were even bleaker.
If they could get a job, it was a very difficult job, and it was, you know, they were dangerous jobs, and that was if you could get one.
We all sort of knew that we weren't cut out for a 9-to-5 job or work in a factory or in an office.
But there was one way out.
I mean, a lot of young people started bands in England because it was that or go on the dole, which is unemployment. It was literally a make or break for life. It was, what else am I going to do?
As young teens, all four took that chance and gave music a shot. Bill and Tony were the first in.
I met Bill through an advert in a shop. They asked what sort of equipment I'd got. Didn't matter how I played. It was more what you got, you know.
At 17, Tony played with a band who landed a tour. He quit his day job, but on his very last day, fate stepped in to change his life forever.
As I'm pushing the metal through into this machine, it just came down like that on my finger. Bang, and I pulled my hand back. And as I pulled it back, I pulled the ends off the fingers. I went to a couple of different doctors, And they said, you know, your guitar playing has ended, sort of thing. And I was absolutely devastated. And so I thought, I wonder if I make some tips, some kind of something on my finger.
After experimenting with several different materials, he found that a simple plastic dish soap bottle did the trick.
And he made his own tips of his fingers out of washing up bottles.
Because he couldn't hold down heavier strings, he figured out a way to use the lightest possible strings and put them at a different length from the fretboard. And in doing that, he created a completely original style that didn't sound like anybody.
Reducing string tension also lowered the pitch. This gave his guitar a deeper, darker sound. After almost a year-long recuperation, Tony felt ready to play again. He and his friend Bill looked for new bandmates.
And we were looking for a singer, and we saw this sign saying, Ozzy Zig requires gig.
I thought, well, I can't remember Ozzy Osbourne. Nobody knows. It didn't. I went, Ozzy Zig needs gig. It kind of rhymed, you know.
And I said, I know an Ozzy, but it can't be him, because he can't sing, as far as I knew.
And lo and behold, it must have done something, because Tony Iommi and Bill Ward turned up to my house, and Geezer Butler did as well.
Ozzy and Tony put aside their old schoolyard antagonisms for a larger goal. If they could make it in music, they might be able to escape Birmingham's factories. But they'd soon find out that band life wasn't all fun and games. By the summer of 1968, the four young men who would become Black Sabbath had formed a band, but they were not called Black Sabbath yet. After trying several names, they settled on Earth. Tony Iommi, Bill Ward, Geezer Butler, and singer Ozzy Osbourne began their musical journey playing rock classics, like so many other bands.
We all played a little bit of Chuck Berry, a little bit of 12-bar blues.
Buddy Holly stuff, things like that.
Their jam sessions produced the bluesy numbers local club owners wanted, but the gigs they managed to get didn't pay very well.
We used to do gigs basically just for the petrol money, really, to put in the van. And we might have a few pence left over to buy fish and chips or chips.
You know, buying Ozzy's first pair of shoes, he didn't even have shoes, man.
I remember one time we found a 10p piece, which is like 25 cents. And we could get French fries for each other or a packet of cigarettes. So we went for the packet of cigarettes.
And that was it, really. We just done it because we loved doing it.
I can remember nights when we hadn't eaten, that when we were actually sick, we all had colds, and we'd drag ourselves onto the stage, and we would go on and we would play like there wasn't even a problem in the world. And I just watched this and I thought, my God, what a band.
They played several times at a local club owned by Jim Simpson. Simpson, who also managed bands, liked what he heard and added Earth to his roster of blues and jazz groups. He booked them in clubs throughout Europe.
I played every gig I could get them in the early years.
That's what bands did, you know, you learnt your craft by performing on the road.
And these gigs made you work. I mean, we had to play like 8 shows a day.
We used to play like from 2 in the morning till 2 in the morning. I'd go in there without no voice because I'd been singing all day.
I came back exhausted, and fingers bleeding and unable to speak.
And in the end, it's just like, okay, you're on. We could have done it in our sleep. We were doing it in our sleep.
Their year of musical boot camp was paying off, but there was one problem they still had to deal with.
I think we were called Earth for about a year, and then this one gig we got, we turned up there and
pulled the van up, and there's this guy outside with a bow tie on and suit. Oh, God.
There's all these older people, and they all had dresses and suits and ties and everything on.
I thought, bloody hell, what's going on here? Because we were really scruffy.
We just thought, God, this is a weird crowd for us.
He said, I really like your single. I went, oh, thanks. I mean, we hadn't done a record at that point. We hadn't done anything.
And we started playing all this, like, blues stuff. And the guy came up and said, what are you doing? Why aren't you playing your regular stuff? And we were going, what do you mean, regular stuff? And it so happened that there was another band called Earth.
Oh, no. He said, well, you know, you're going to have to play now because you're the only band here. So we went on and we died a death. I mean, we played probably 2 songs and they threw it there. We had to get off.
While the four struggled to come up with the perfect name, they also continued to experiment with a different musical approach. Slower, darker songs that went against the flower power sound of the peace and love generation. And their lyrics began reflecting Tony's interest in horror films and Geezer's passion for occult novels.
What I remember happening was we used to rehearse across the road from a movie theater. I believe it was Tony says, isn't it strange that people go to movies and pay money to be scared. Why don't we start writing scary music?
What is this that's
That made the template for where we were going, because as soon as we'd done that song, that was it, you know, we knew exactly where we were going.
It was almost the final piece of the jigsaw. We knew we were going somewhere, musically it was going the right direction, we hadn't got a name. One day, Geezer cheekily poked his face around my dining room door and said, I got it.
My brother's seen the film Black Sabbath, I think it was in 1966 or something, and I just love the name.
So now, all the pieces were in place. A distinct sound, original songs, and a provocative name, Black Sabbath. Manager Jim Simpson borrowed £500 so the band could record a demo tape.
Well, actually, the recording was a day. And then they mixed it the next day.
And we got the gear and set up, recorded these songs in 12 hours.
For us to go in the studio was just like doing a show.
Simpson visited several labels, hoping to score a record deal.
I actually went around 14 major record companies. I got 14 straight no's.
They weren't familiar with our, well, nobody was familiar with our music, really.
Go to the Billboard Top 40 and see what was passing for radio in that time. See the environment that Black Sabbath had to deal with.
And then to hear Sabbath, it was like, whoa, what is that?
You've got to put yourself back in this period of time. And they were trying to sell love, peace, and bells and flowers.
Some particular songs were maddening, actually. Some of the songs from America where everything was totally cool and okay. And, you know, even though the Vietnam War was raging at that point.
Instead of, if you go to San Francisco. And then all of a sudden we just come up with this heavy, what is this that stands before me line.
It was such a different vibe for the time.
Because we didn't see that. We didn't see all the love and peace. It was all violence.
There was a progressive label. We were under the category of progressive music, whatever that means. It's different music. And Jim came up and says, I want to do a deal with you. And we were like, what?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
In December 1969, after 2 years together, Black Sabbath signed with Vertigo Records. 2 months later, the label released their demo tape, As Is, on Friday the 13th, 1970. Black Sabbath's self-titled debut was about to get a reception that nobody in their wildest dreams would have expected. By 1970, after 2 years of playing clubs throughout Europe, Black Sabbath developed a unique sound while building a fan base with each appearance. They had all the keys to the Black Sabbath mystique firmly in place. Macabre lyrics, ominous-sounding guitars, and a devilishly compelling name. Their self-titled debut album was released on Friday the 13th, 1970. Hyping the band's occult edge, their record company had added an inverted cross to the album art.
We didn't see the record sleeve until the week it came out.
They didn't consult. If they'd have consulted with us, we wouldn't have had the inverted cross on the first album.
We liked the front cover, but we didn't like the inverted cross. Especially me, because I had to take it home and show my parents, and they went absolutely mental.
But that hardly dampened the band's excitement.
It came when I was like, I'm on the radio, Mom, I'm on the radio.
Within a month, the album shot up to number 8 on the UK album chart. Even their label was surprised it went so far, so fast.
That first album, I think, is a really important musical document.
Man, Tony Iommi is just one of the great metal architects.
Obviously, he didn't copy anybody's sound because I never heard a guitar like that before.
Tony's guitar riffs, the basic building blocks of melody lines, hooked listeners as much as the lyrics.
They started the whole riff thing, you know, coming up with licks instead of just strumming a guitar. It wasn't your typical songs with a chorus.
Then there was Ozzy Osbourne with his anguished howl of a voice and rousing on-stage personality.
Ozzy's got so much charisma, see? You know, I mean, Ozzy walk on stage in this little club with two people and the dog there, and you're riveted to that guy on stage when he walks out.
Everything about him is so genuine. He's not a part-time rock and roller.
Bill's hard-driving backbeats and Geezer's sledgehammer bass lines were also integral to the Black Sabbath sound.
Bill Ward is an uncanny percussionist. He plays behind the beat.
Bill Ward, man, it's like the drummer on the Muppets. You know, he's just...
I'm an orchestrational drummer. I bring images to the music.
And Geezer Butler is one of the best, if under-mentioned, bass players anywhere, anytime.
Geezer was a great bass player, but I think even more of his contribution was his lyrics.
If it's a love song, it's a downer love song. The guy loses the girl. Songs about war, you know, of religion gone wrong.
I mean, I put them up with a lot of Bob Dylan's protest songs at the time.
Within a few months, Black Sabbath went platinum. Eager to capitalize on this success, the label had the band quickly record a follow-up album tentatively titled War Pigs. But producer Roger Bain felt the album needed one more track.
Roger Bain said, we need 3 or 4 minutes to finish the album. Jam something. So, like, in not so many minutes later, we'd done the song. Tony had come up with a riff. I'd come up with a melody line, Geezer would give me the riffs, and Bill would come up with the drum pattern. And it was just spur of the moment.
The song, Paranoid. The record label scrapped the title War Pigs. They'd found the album's name.
The first Black Sabbath song that I heard was Paranoid. And I thought it was cool because it was dealing with this dark subject of losing your mind and losing control of your mind. I still think it's one of the most powerful 2.5 minute songs in the history of rock and roll. It's unforgettable.
Tony and his riffs would go, there ain't no way he can beat that. There's no way under the sun he can beat that riff. And sure enough, next time he'd come around, he'd have one bigger and better.
I mean, you can't make a heavier song than that.
He's the king. He's the absolute riff king.
Iron Man was the ultimate anthem for disenfranchised youth around America and all over the world.
He seeks revenge. He goes back to the people who shunned him, and he wipes them out. And that's every ninth grader.
In the subconscious of many young males around the world, Iron Man became that kind of anthem. You live through that fantasy.
Back in those days, no one's writing a hard rock song with some get back in it. And there's a lot of people in the world who didn't get invited to the party and didn't date the cheerleader.
The album Paranoid hit number one on the UK charts and number 12 in the States, proving that Black Sabbath's heavy music resonated with rock fans. But the rock press felt very differently.
Critics, I don't think, ever got Black Sabbath, especially in the first couple of albums.
They hated those records. They took every opportunity they could to take a shot at them and take a stab at them.
One-star reviews, people just saying, like, burn this.
They didn't like us. The press didn't like us.
Like, for the good of music, just get rid of this band.
I think I kind of stopped reading reviews because I knew how hard we'd worked. So, yeah, it hurt me.
It is disappointing, but, you know, it's got to be like that. You've got to have people that don't like it. We had a lot of people that didn't like it.
Despite critical pans, their third album, 1971's Master of Reality, was their biggest hit yet. In less than 2 years, they moved 4 million albums and singles. A larger management firm lured the band away from Jim Simpson, persuading them that he was simply out of his league. Guided by this new organization, the band commanded up to $200,000 for a major concert. Black Sabbath was nothing short of a phenomenon.
One day we had absolutely nothing. The next day we had, like, money. We could buy cigarettes in the middle of the week. We could buy beer. And then when we got to America, it was like a... It's like, you know.
It was the epitome of what one would call sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Women over in America in those days would just tell you what they wanted to do. Not in England, you'd go, can I take you out? You take her out, buy her a box of chocolate and all the rest of it, and eventually pop the question. She goes, no, I'm a virgin, you know. But in America, it was like the boys had arrived in Playtown, you know.
And we started to delve into narcotics.
We discovered this stuff back then called cocaine. And we started to get large amounts of that sent around and booze, pot, because we were rock stars, you know.
We were on top of the world and we were coming in to make a fourth album.
We'd hired this big house in Bel Air, crammed it with groupies and all the drugs you could ever wish to get up your nose.
The original title for that album wasn't Volume 4. We were going to call it Snowblind, but the record company says, no way. And if you look on this sleeve, it's got, we'd like to thank the great American Coca-Cola Company.
It was a great time to be in the music industry because it was great music, great live performances, great drugs, great f***ing, great everything. Everything was excess, and it was fantastic.
I'm in the house one day, and there's a big bowl of pot on the table.
We had a big bowl of cocaine, I mean, literally a fruit bowl. And it was piled high with cocaine like this on the middle of the table.
And it's really, really hot one day, and I push his button on the wall thinking it's the air conditioning. And it wasn't, it was the alarm for the Bel Air Patrol, and all these cop cars come screaming. I'm going, we're busted, man. So I run into the bathroom, I'm trying to get rid of it all.
I mean, like, they're all getting all the drugs off and slinging it down the toilet and trying to flush it all.
My heart was jumping out of my chest anyway, because I thought we were busted, you know.
They didn't search us or anything. So we'd just like thrown away about 20 grand's worth of cocaine.
Whether or not the drugs were to blame, in 1973, Tony experienced writer's block for the first time while preparing the next album, Sabbath Bloody Sabbath. For a change of scene, they returned to the UK and set up in a neo-Gothic castle.
We rehearsed in the dungeons there.
One thing I do know, we used to like goof around and try and frighten each other.
The room Bill was in, supposedly, every now and again, this figure comes through and jumps out the window. So Bill's in this room. I got this fishing line.
They actually had fishing line that went down through the window and dropped down into the courtyard. So when I sat in my bed, I was scraping the picture across so it looked like the picture was moving.
And I'd only go, who's that? What's that? And then the curtains would move, you know, just silly jokes, really.
Even though they lived really far away from this castle, Bill ended up commuting because he was so uncomfortable staying in this place where he thought there was a ghost. Before he left, he slept with a dagger every night.
So, Bill, what are you going to do with that? Well, you never know, you know, they might... That dead Bill, you know.
The experience at the castle recharged the band's creative engine, and critics took note of Sabbath Bloody Sabbath's more complex sound. For the first time, the band got positive reviews. But management struggles overshadowed the good news. First, former manager Jim Simpson sued the band for wrongful termination. Then they discovered their current managers engaged in questionable accounting practices.
They were prime examples of what went on in the music industry in the early 70s, where it was very rare that the bands actually got any money.
I, for one, didn't join a band to become an accountant or a lawyer or understand. I still to this day don't understand contracts.
They were in a den of vipers. They couldn't get out. The lawyers, the accountants, the record companies, everyone was a thief. So the band got destroyed by people's greed.
At one 1974 California festival, their fee was $250,000, yet each member received only $1,000. The group sued. The managers brought their own countersuits and froze the band's assets. Black Sabbath had to tour constantly just to pay legal fees. The grueling, relentless schedule would take a heavy toll.
And Ozzy didn't turn up for like 6 weeks.
By the mid-70s, Black Sabbath had several multi-platinum albums to their credit, but all was not well with the band. Beset by lawsuits, debt, and management issues, Black Sabbath had to tour relentlessly just to pay legal fees.
At that time, we'd been fighting everybody. We'd go on the road to pay the lawyers. I mean, the whole magic was getting polluted with legal ramblings, you know.
Other issues caused more friction.
I know that individual tastes were becoming, from each member, were becoming stronger and wanted attention.
They'd be in the studio, and then one wouldn't like what the other one had done, and the other wouldn't like the other one done.
I always liked the rawness of the early Sabbath stuff. And then we sort of got into a thing where we just, there's tons of overdubs on this and that.
Then it just became clash of personalities, really.
Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, in my opinion, was the end of the Black Sabbath thing.
Tony was wanting to move in a different direction, and that was not necessarily Ozzy's direction.
Geezer would say, we've got to get hit songs, we've got to do this, we've got to change. We weren't into what we were about anymore, you know.
Against this tumultuous backdrop, they were expected to go on a whirlwind 10th anniversary tour. The 1978 outing was especially challenging. The schedule forced them to ping-pong back and forth across Europe and America, playing over 100 dates in 6 months. The band relied on drugs and alcohol to help get through the intense schedule.
At first, I think that the drugs were good at the time, when what we all did, you know. But later on, I think it caused more harm than good, you know. It was getting worse.
And of course, the old paranoia kicks in then when you start getting on some of that stuff.
I crossed over a line where there was no coming back. What happened was alcohol and narcotics became more important than anything, and that included Black Sabbath.
They were guys not treating themselves as well as they should have. And Ozzy was having some real problems just dealing, just like getting to the stage at night.
I mean, I've been kicking doors off hotel rooms to get him out of bed. I mean, physically kicking the door down and paying the damage because it was cheaper than missing a flight and cancelling a gig.
We found Ozzy prone in a couple of hotels, lying in the corridor with the people who was with it abandoned him because he never got up again.
It just went out of control, totally out of control.
By this time, they'd sold close to 20 million records worldwide. But after 8 albums and 10 years together, Black Sabbath was coming apart at the seams.
A lot of it came on the Never Say Die tour. I think Van Halen was supporting us.
It was our first tour. It was 1978. We were doing anything and everything we ever read about and then some.
And if you listen to the bootlegs of that tour, all the songs are kind of done at 78 speed. I mean, it sounds like the tape's going too fast, but they were coked.
And to make matters worse, the band was clearly losing commercial traction. Sales of their last 3 albums failed to reach the levels of their previous 5. Now the record label was putting its promotional muscle behind their opening act, the rising young hard rock stars, Van Halen. For Black Sabbath, the pressure was on.
We were kind of a double-edged sword to them, I guess. We forced them to have to rise to the occasion, so to speak, to follow us.
Warner Brothers were losing interest in us as well. They were putting all this money into Van Halen and completely ignored us, you know.
And the record company didn't give a damn for us.
Warner Brothers had this party for us when Never Say Die was coming out. And we got to the party. Nobody knew who we are. They weren't going to let us in at first. And we got in and they were playing Bob Marley because nobody liked Sabbath.
The band's morale was at an all-time low. And just when it seemed things could not possibly get worse, they did. It was November 1978 in Nashville, and Ozzy was simply burnt out.
I'd been on a run for about 3 or 4 days, you know, not sleeping, and 6:30 in the morning we get to this Nashville place, and the hotel.
He was so dinged out that we left the last city, and he had the key of the last hotel in his hand.
So I put my hand out and I pulled the key out, and it was the wrong key, and I go to the wrong floor.
And he's like half asleep, walking around, you know.
And as I'm going to this, oh, look at the number on this key ring, it's got whatever it was. And then Mae just coming out, oh, go in, lie on the bed. Next minute I know, I'm not woke up, and I'm going, wow, that was a good kid.
So we were supposed to do sound check, and nobody could find him.
Finally, around all the rooms, come on, boys, get downstairs. Then no, I say. I went out looking out all around the bars. Couldn't find him anywhere.
So the police were looking for him because they thought somebody had kidnapped him.
So we had to cancel the show.
And on the phone, Albert, and Albert goes insane at me, and I'm like, where the hell are you? I'm in my room. What are you doing? Where are you? We had the police, the FBI, everybody.
Yeah, he must have slept, I don't know, at least 18 hours because he missed the whole day.
Thousands of furious fans trashed the concert hall. The other band members were exasperated at having to cancel the show, but relieved that no harm had come to Ozzy.
And of course, the next album after Never Say Die was when it just all fell to pieces.
Ozzy just wasn't into it anymore. He was really bad on drugs and booze at the time. When we finally went over to record the album, Ozzy didn't turn up for like 6 weeks. And when he did turn up, He just came into the house and he was out of his brains. So I thought, oh, God.
My alcohol and drug abuse was... But we were all... I wasn't the only one. We were all doing it, you know, but I suppose I'd go hit the floor before everyone else.
We'd be jamming away and he just wasn't interested at all. So, you know, it just had to happen. But, you know, we knew that something had to drastically change within the band.
It got to a point where the band was going to say, well, that's it, let's just break up then. Or we get somebody else and carry on.
For more than a decade, Ozzy Osbourne had been the frontman for Black Sabbath. But the others had decided enough was enough.
It wasn't my decision, it was Bill, Geezer and myself.
It was like the most unbelievable thing at first. It was like, because we, you know, because of how we were towards each other and how we felt towards each other.
Which is awful. I mean, it was an awful thing because we'd been together a lot of years at that point.
So I volunteered to talk to Oz and let him know the truth about what was going on. He was lying down at the time and looked square on at me. And he says, you kidding? I says, no, I'm not kidding. And then the rest is kind of private.
We were all upset. I mean, we were all crying when, you know, when it happened, because none of us wanted it to happen. It's just one of those things that had to happen.
I remember thinking, that's it, it's over. You know, I remember thinking, I've done it, it's over. It's a very sad part. Black Sabbath was the best thing that ever happened to me up until that point.
When a group of them set one aside, you can imagine how that one felt. And Ozzy was like, now he was on his own. He'd never been on his own. He was broke, on his own, and scared.
After 11 years of hard rocking and hard living, Black Sabbath had become one of the biggest names in rock. But drugs, endless touring, management disputes, and creative differences had finally taken their toll. In 1979, Tony Iommi, Geezer Butler, and Bill Ward decided that Ozzy Osbourne was no longer holding up his end. They saw no other choice but to part ways with their lead singer, even though he was wildly popular with fans.
It was tough, because here we are, bringing in a new singer. We wanted somebody who would fit in and somebody that would... Nobody's going to go, oh, he sounds just like Ozzy, you know.
Veteran rock manager Don Arden had been brought in to work with the group. His daughter Sharon was part of the management team.
They didn't want Ozzy, and they had no singer. So I said, listen to Ronnie Dio. He's, you know, he's got a great voice.
American-born singer Ronnie James Dio was a star in his own right, having fronted another popular hard rock group, Rainbow.
So by bringing Ronnie in, it launched us again, and it's a challenge again. It really made us work.
And they made an album called Heaven and Hell, which to me is one of the most together rock albums I have ever heard.
Technically, he's a much better singer than Ozzy. He could do a lot more.
It was good. He has that range, that high voice for that genre music.
In my mind, every record that Dio did with Sabbath, to me, they're necessary listening.
It was difficult for Ronnie to have to go out in front of people and, you know, when we started touring. Because here he is, taking over from Ozzy. It was a difficult task, you know, really difficult. And I thought Ronnie done such a great job of doing it.
When Ozzy Osbourne left Black Sabbath, I don't think anybody expected that the band would survive. And even more so, anybody who knew anything about Ozzy Osbourne probably had little reason to expect that he would ever continue on as a solo artist.
He was near death, Ozzy, then. A long period, he sat in the hotel room and never came out.
He was afraid to go out of the door because he was just so emotionally beaten.
Ozzy just couldn't see. He just lost everything in himself. We all had problems. That's why none of us could sort of help him, because we all had our own problems at the time.
Sharon Arden saw Ozzy's potential as a solo artist.
Sharon came around one day and she said, you know what? You straighten yourself up and we want to manage you. I thought, what can I do?
We said to him, if you, you know, pull yourself together, come on, let's get your confidence back. And you can do it. You can do it on your own.
And Sharon completely saved his life.
After being holed up for 3 months, Sharon knew Ozzy had to take baby steps at first.
I wanted him to take pride in himself. And I think it starts from taking a shower every day, to washing your hair, to putting on some new clothes.
With Ozzy feeling better about himself, the search began for a backing band. Ozzy teamed up with guitar virtuoso Randy Rhoads and returned to creating over-the-top hard rock laced with his trademark dark imagery. The result, a string of platinum-selling albums.
The chemistry of Ozzy Osbourne and Randy Rhoads is a great band right there. Those two guys together created some incredible music that actually held up to Black Sabbath, which is really difficult to do.
I think the Prince of Darkness thing was something he played around with, but the press ran with it. And you see on the solo albums, Diary of a Madman and all of that, he's got the makeup going, the werewolf thing, you know, bark at the moon with the fangs taped into, you know, glued into his mouth. He's kind of going along with it.
He's a smart guy, and he's been through a lot. And he's an absolute character, and the world needs characters, and rock and roll needs characters.
I've been applauding him all the way because we've always stayed in touch. We've never been away from each other. So when he brought out his first record, I mean, I can remember where we were. Oz came up with Blizzard of Oz, and he was like, here it is, you know, and he came in, and it's like, yeah.
Over the 3 years since they had parted company, Black Sabbath and Ozzy had each succeeded on their own. Then in 1982, old wounds reopened when both camps released live albums within days of each other. There was a grim reason for Ozzy's live effort. His guitarist Randy Rhoads was killed in an airplane crash, leaving Ozzy in a difficult situation.
What happened with me was I'd done a live album with Randy Rhoads, and then we were contractually obliged to deliver a live album. And then Randy got killed. No one, you know, I don't want to put that live album at Randy Rhoads so soon after his death. And it's just bad taste, you know. And I said, well, we've got to do a live album. So I said, somebody should have made the suggestion to go and do Sabbath stuff in a live album. That's what I did.
Yeah, that was a bit disappointing for us. To hear somebody else playing those songs, you know, with Ozzy. It was a bit strange, certainly.
It wasn't pre-planned. It wasn't a vicious stab in the back to them trying to ruin their record. Hand on heart, it wasn't.
I don't even play the album. I don't want to. It's not me on my album. It's me trying to cop Sabbath, and that was the only thing I could do for the time, you know.
I had no idea what they were doing. They didn't have any idea what ours, but it came out, and then it was, of course, another stab in the back for all of the guys. They started it all off again, you know.
And Sabbath's live album caused its own set of problems within the band. Ronnie James Dio believed his vocals were not prominent enough in the mix. In the end, they could not resolve their differences and Dio quit. For the next album, the band brought in former Deep Purple frontman, Ian Gillan.
Ian was a great heavy rock singer who kind of came from the same background. It seemed to work on paper. And the album was good, but it just wasn't Black Sabbath.
Through the 1980s, Sabbath saw many personnel changes.
Okay, that's enough of that one. I went a bit longer than I thought I was going to, but it's all good. And yeah, the world does need characters. Whether that's sex and drugs and rock and roll, or whether it's people in the new age world, or people in the pagan world, or whatever it is, it's people just being themselves, expressing their consciousness. And your consciousness might be in a tough place some of the time, but you've still got to express it. Still got to express it. And it's healthier to express it than it is not to, sometimes. Anyway, that's kind of where I'm at. I'm kind of stuck in the mid-80s. So I've gone back to being 20 years old for a little while. And I moved to London in 1988, which is a long time ago now. I left college and I spent about a year unemployed. Couldn't get a job. Couldn't get a job no matter how hard I tried. Nobody was really interested. Went on a thing called the Enterprise Allowance Scheme, which was £40 a week allowance for being self-employed and setting up a business. So I set something up and I tried to promote it, and I just couldn't figure it out at all. But I was 22 at that point, so I didn't really know what I was doing. I still don't really know what I'm doing now, but and there's 30 years gone by since then. But you live and learn. You live and learn. I got stuck. I got stuck in a bit of a depression over the winter, and I had to do something. So I kind of made the decision to move. And it took me, I made the decision, I made the decision to make a decision in April 1988, it must have been. So I made the decision to make a decision at the Glastonbury Festival. And I made the decision to move at the Glastonbury Festival. And then we were going down to the Redden Festival on the August Bank Holiday. That's probably why this has come up, because it's just been August Bank Holiday again. So that's probably why I'm talking about all this stuff again. So I took some extra clothes down with me because I had a lift. And I arranged on the Monday to go and stay with a friend in Twickenham, like his sister's place. So it had been wet all weekend and I hadn't had a shower, so I was covered in mud, smelling bad, carrying an extra couple of bags with me. Got cleaned up at John's sister's place. Went to my sister's place after that because she was away on holiday. And then within 3 days, I'd found myself a job at the university accommodation office, which meant I could find myself a place to live that wasn't my sister's bedsit. So within a week, I had a place to live, and I had a reasonably good job, temporary job, in the accommodation office for a month. But it set me up. It got me started again, got me moving again after the heaviness of Newcastle. And it was all coincidental. It was all kind of, I mean, I set up the process, but I didn't know how the process was going to happen, really. I just knew my sister was away on holiday. I knew we were at the Redden Festival. So I knew I could have somewhere to stay in London for that week. So I thought, I'll give it a week, see what happens. Went down to pay £250 overdraft off and stayed for 18 years. And that's how that happened anyway. But it was all synchronicity. It's like I didn't really do any of it. It just kind of happened once I'd made the decision. There you go. That's that part of the story. I'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.
Everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Be evasive. But that doesn't mean that they're telling the truth as opposed to fiction.
And Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. And there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came and unto the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God, plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
What the heck is the truth, jihad? Hey, I'm Kevin Barrett, host of Truth Jihad Radio. Federal prosecutors, Department of Homeland Security agents, and curious passersby often ask me, just what is this truth jihad thing anyway? Well, everybody knows what truth is, but jihad is a misunderstood term. Jihad means effort or struggle. The greater jihad is the struggle to be a better person, while the lesser jihad is the struggle to defend the community. Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, did say that the best jihad is a word of truth flung in the face of a tyrant. And that's what we do here at Truth Jihad Radio. Every Friday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Pacific, right here on Revolution Radio.